barbecue a former police officer, and there's video of him and his cannibalism eating human beings. Mm-hmm. Americans are barely being able to evacuate and escape the chaos there. People are running for their lives. It's just pandemonium. I mean, it's so tragic.
It is tragic, Armstrong, especially for me. I spent over 7 years in and out of Haiti pre and after the earthquake. In fact, I was appointed the cultural ambassador by the former Prime Minister of Haiti, Prime Minister Michel Pierre Louis Duvalier, and also worked for the Clinton Foundation for the rehabilitation of Haiti, and subsequently left that to work with the Haitians' grassroots organizations themselves, especially after the earthquake. And that whole initiative about the rehabilitation of Haiti after the earthquake was to not only rebuild Haiti, but to European and American standards. I also had the opportunity to work with the women who were running for government. We actually created a quota where women had to be a representative in that particular parliament. And I worked with the nonprofits and worked with getting medical supplies there and trying to increase the education for the students in the universities whose schools had failed during that time, and actually took them on to be the host committee for the rehabilitation of Haiti under President Clinton. And they actually had to correct some of the work from one of the greatest research agencies, the McKinley Group, with French and all of that. So when I'm seeing what's happening now and watching him, first, the red flag was the assassination of the former president was a red flag for me. Haiti then became a failed state. I interacted with Haiti under Preval and Martelly. I was in Haiti also during the cholera breakout, and that's another story. But for this issue, to see the barbarity that is happening and to see the, and I hate to use the word, animalistic things that are happening there is painful, but certain things evolved in that country for centuries, right? And when you don't have the leadership, or you have co-opted leadership, or you don't resonate with the people, there was a great economic divide in Haiti as well. In fact, one of the things that I tried to do was to sort of suture the relationship between the bourgeois Haitians, you know, the light-skinned Haitians, with the people in the street. That was a very Herculean effort. So when you have the assassination of a president and you have these gang formations coming in, I mean, they make Chicago look tame, I hate to say it. And then you see, like you talked about, the cannibalism. That is not only brutality, it's also, and it's not, I can't even co-opt and say that it's a desperation, but it shows what happens when people are left to themselves, when you don't have good governance, and when you leave them with extreme hope. They were undermined by so many outside forces, having to pay France back for being victorious over slavery. But that still doesn't excuse a citizenry gone wild. So now we have our U.S. forces over there, as you said, trying to extrapolate our citizens and the diplomats that are over there out of the country. And that's a Herculean feat because people who have not been to Haiti, it's mountainous, the roads, it's crumbling. You don't know where they're hiding and who is for such. I have a great lamentation over that, what is happening there.
How has there ever been a time where they've enjoyed peace and some solidarity where the government actually function? It seems as though Haiti has always been on the cusp of just exploding like it is now.
You know when Haiti operated the best? Under the dictatorship of Papa Doc. In fact, it was called the French Riviera. It's where the movie stars would come, and they would, Catherine Dunham, who was from my hometown of Chicago, who had a PhD in sociology and dance ethnography, would go there. In fact, she had a villa called the Habitation Park, and all the stars, and even President Clinton and Hillary had their honeymoon there, or they came there, and it was that. The promenade was beautiful, the roads were beautiful. It's just as if you were in the southern France. But after him, I can't remember what president came after him, then it started to fall, because we also, in our geopolitics, had our favorites as well. There was Aristide, right? And Aristide had to leave the country, and he went to Africa. Then after Baby Doc also had to leave, there was not a time in Haitian history where the presidents at any point in time could actually live in that island republic after their presidency. There was one time which that happened, and I took Howard Universities during that time, and they met them. Baby Doc, Aristide, and that particular time, Martelly was the first time in Haitian history that three presidents could live on that same island without them fighting one another. But what's wrong with Haiti is what I say when I look at our own governance, what I say when I go look at the poverty on the continent of Africa and the various countries, in which I tell leadership the real thing that has impoverished is our leadership and our loyalty to our citizenry, so they do not get to that degree of denigration of one's humanity. I mean, it makes, like I said, my hometown of Chicago, which we call now the Wild Wild Midwest, or what we see the increase in crime, regardless of what people are saying, when you have 256 cars broken into at the Capitol Arena during an event, and homeless people in that. So we're on a fray of the flag is not only frayed, but our society has come frayed, and Haiti is the worst a representation of that. But at the same time, you have to go back, like with us as African Americans and the trajectory, or anybody else who've been oppressed, how did they go from this situation to be really in the bowels of the devil without any excuses?
Help us understand the cannibalism.
That's a lack of appreciation for one's humanity, and it rears its head in different forms.
It doesn't seem like it's something new, though.
No. There are cliques, but there are some societies into which that might have been performative within that Haitian society. In my 7 years, I never heard of it. No one ever spoke about it. And I went to visit the head of the voodoo, when I went to Haiti, because as a minister, I wanted to see what was influencing the people and how to resonate with the people based upon their underground religion. And I don't call it an underground religion, but because of Catholicism, they could not keep the traditional religion, which they brought over on the slave ship with them, right? It's the same thing as Santeria in Cuba, or Candomblé in Brazil. But again, we can't look at what is happening with the cannibalism and make it monolithic all Haitians, just no more than we can say that the brother who is shooting a brother or stealing or raping women that come from our tribe are the representation of all of us. But to me, the stem comes from not being able to govern the country, the abuse that they got from their former slave owners, right? And the continued geopolitics that undermine it, mostly for resources that people do not know that Haiti has under that island.
You know, it also shows how far U.S. stability efforts must go.
Yes, well, after the earthquake, they were promised $1.4 billion. Mm-hmm. They never saw that. And people say, well, you can't give it to them because of the corruption. Well, I beg to differ, and I wrote an article about it. There were worthwhile grassroots organizations. There were individuals who helped to rebuild Haiti before the initiative to do so under President Clinton. We were having meetings at a building that was at a hotel owned by a Haitian that was destroyed, built back to the American and European standards.
You're getting into the Global Fragility Act now. Mm-hmm. A lot of people feel that it cannot be implemented, but some say if it's implemented properly, it could work.
If you engage the people, in order to engage them, it's not being didactic to them. It's actually, which my job was, to help them rehabilitate their country so you could have a sense of pride. You know how we like to say, we built the White House, that's why we should be in the White House, because you touch on a cornerstone of what you feel democracy is, and you're engaged in it. But when it goes south, when it sinks, as it has done, this failed state in Haiti, then you are removed from that deal, just like a lot of our kids are absent of the history. Well, when the universities close and the schools are closed, then they too are disconnected from that pride. And even though we might think that some dictators or all dictators are bad, it ironically worked best under Papa Doc.
And why?
Everybody was proud. Well, because remember, when you colonize or you're in slavery, we are run amok. We do, right? And so I think as a bad father, but who was more disciplined with them, the people were engaged. And so it's it wasn't an either or, but it was kind of a both and, that you knew that you had the civility. People would come there from around the world. They felt safe being there.
Are you saying that you need a mixture of both? Well, a mixture of both to make it work now?
Not necessarily, but for the Island Republic, given their history, it did work under Papa Doc more than it has done under any other president.
You're saying you need a strong arm leadership there.
You need, was if you're going to go amok, not a strong arm, but you need an engaging arm. Now, after subsequently after Papa Doc, I think that the possibility of having a true democratic republic could have happened on the island. But then, too, foreign entities come in and they undermine that. Because at a certain point, when you want certain resources...
But the country has been raped.
It has been raped.
And the citizenry realizes it.
Well, so you have a woundedness. It's like a woman. When you ask, why is this woman acting bizarre? Why is this woman not taking care of her children? Why is this woman on the street? Because it's somewhat, I would put it since it's Women History Month, it's spousal abuse. It really is. When you've been battered and beaten down so much, and your children have been beaten and down so that you really gravitate to your lower sense of, you know, they said
the lowest common denominator. The
denominator and your lesser angels. You know, and it's very, like I said, it's very complex, but we can have some of those stimulants, but not as bad, even in our own country, right? And the how and the way in which we cannibalize one another. It seems to be more formalized or more polite, but in the ways we're facing cannibalism, the way we bite at each other, the way we cancel one another, but never
but
to the extreme.
We're not biting flesh.
No, but we're not. But we're not feasting on
no,
it.
No, we're not feasting.
So you know what? You know what? This is the time of Ramadan for a lot of individuals, and a lot of people are praying regardless of the faith. I'm praying for this whole world. I'm praying for Haiti. I'm praying that some help for the people there who are not engaged in this acidic gain formation and the brutality that they're putting on their other people.
You know, everyone knows the name of Marion Williamson, a best-selling author, advice guru, and we've tried for the last several months to have her on our show, and you know, it worked out. She's joining us tonight. Ms. Williamson, welcome to our broadcast house.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for having the courage to run for president. It's expensive. It's exhausting. You have little no control over your life. And I always say anybody that makes the commitment to run for president, to offer voters an alternative that is deserving of the highest respect and honor, because that, to me, is the ultimate sacrifice.
Thank you. I sort of have to agree with you at this point. So, Your congratulations received with gratitude.
You know, in the context of your recent decision to re-enter the presidential race, could you discuss the main motivations and goals that influenced your decision to once again seek the Democratic nomination for president of the United States? And how do you believe your campaign can impact the current political climate that we find ourselves in?
After the first three primary states, it was clear that my numbers were so low that there was no way I would be able to, close the delegate gap and really be any kind of a contender for the nomination. And for that reason, I suspended my campaign. But it didn't take me too long to realize that something bigger than the horse game is at stake here. The DNC had decided that there would be no primary. At the very beginning, the DNC had said that they saw their job as simply helping Joe Biden be renominated. They felt that the threat to democracy represented by Donald Trump was so great that they felt it was their responsibility and that they were entitled to basically make it very difficult, if not impossible, for anyone else to have a say in this campaign season. And then that's what happened. And I found myself blocked in various ways. Kicked off ballots, blacklisted on CNN and MSNBC, et cetera. So I saw how the system is rigged. I saw how the game is played. After I suspended, because given the circumstances, are you not hearing me or something?
Oh, no, I'm hearing you well. I'm sorry, I hear you well. Please continue.
Yeah. So after experiencing that and then coming in so low in the in those first three states, I suspended and then realized something bigger than the horse race is at stake here. The conversation is what's important. I'm having a conversation with the American people that the president is not having and that Trump is not having. 39% of Americans now report that they're regularly skipping meals in order to pay their rent. Half of the renters in the United States cannot afford their rent. One in four Americans are living with medical debt. We have 1.3 million Americans who are rationing their insulin. 70% of Americans say that they live with chronic economic anxiety. The majority of Americans unable to absorb a $1,000 expenditure and are living paycheck to paycheck. There is ubiquitous economic despair in this country. And all that the system is offering is a little tweak here and a little tweak there. We need fundamental economic reform. And I don't feel that that conversation should end simply because the system makes sure that anybody who even gets that deep and gets real doesn't have a chance at the conversation. So I'm staying in. And with every vote that I get, there is a greater opportunity, greater chance that I will be able to influence the platform, influence the president, influence the convention, and so forth.
The things that you've mentioned that the American people suffer from and are not getting the leadership that is necessary, you don't find all those answers in the current president of the United States, Joe Biden? He can't address those things? Do you feel the part of the reason why you are running is because you think that Joe Biden has also failed the American people in many ways as the titular head of the Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the larger context. Let's not leave out Donald Trump. There have been people who've said to me from the beginning, "Why are you doing this? Don't you realize the fascists are at the door?" I'm doing this because the fascists are at the door. We are not going to beat Donald Trump unless we offer a lot more than the same old, let's finish the job. We need, for instance, Medicare for all. We have 68,000 Americans who die every year because of lack of health care. We have 75 to 90 million Americans who are either underinsured or uninsured. We have millions of Americans whose health insurance will cover their visit to the doctor, but it won't cover the test that the doctor wants them to have. It won't cover the operation the doctor thinks they need. And for 18 million Americans, it won't cover the prescription drugs that the doctor prescribes. So this president has said that he would veto a Medicare for all bill. And yet a Medicare for all bill is what we need. Now, a majority of Republicans, as well as Democrats, say that they want that. It is considered a moderate position. Every other advanced democracy has it. These are the kinds of things that we need in order to defeat Donald Trump. So, no, President Biden is talking about how over the next 10 years we're lowering prescription drug prices. No, that's not enough. We need Medicare for all. The president has talked about the $35 cap on insulin for people over 65. Well, first of all, we have a lot of people with diabetes in this country who are under 65. And in any other advanced democracy, insulin would be free because of universal health care. So this is an example. The president is the corporatist Democratic agenda, which definitely seeks to ameliorate the stress of people who are living within an unjust economy. I want to end the injustice.
So, what are your thoughts on the border crisis, which seems to be the most important issue to the American people, the crisis at our borders?
Well, on that, I would have to agree with President Biden. There was a bipartisan bill. It had everything the Republicans said that they wanted. It was a compromise. It was something like $8.5 billion. It would give us the infrastructure that we need down there. The agents, the people who know how to interrogate. Is there an establishment of credible fear? Moving people on to the next stage, otherwise making sure that people need to go home to their native countries, et cetera. That's what we need down there. And we were going to have it. The bill was made. It would give the president all of the power, including the power to close the border if he wanted to at any point. And instead, it was Donald Trump who came in. Donald Trump who came in and said to the same Republican leaders who had helped write the bill, not to pass it, to kill it. Why? Because he knew it would work. And he knew that in its working, that would give President Biden and the Democrats in general a win during an election year, and he didn't want it.
You know,
I also
running for president of the United States is a numbers game. How do you get to the delegates? And I'm not sure if that's really your goal, because I think you're saying something more important, that you want to bring attention to issues that nobody's talking about that impact the daily lives of everyday Americans, the insulin, the health care. But how do you, is that your goal? Or do you think your goal is to have a pathway to winning the nomination for the Democratic Party?
If I had been treated fairly, I would have had that pathway. Remember, the DNC was overt about the fact that they saw their Their job as helping the president get the nomination, which, as we know, is not the traditional role of the political party. The role of the political party is to stand in the background until the people have decided. But the situation was created in which it was very difficult for me to get my message to the people. I was blacklisted on CNN this year. I was blacklisted on MSNBC. No Democratic candidate for can get anywhere when the media platforms that most Democrats watch don't even showcase you, never on one of the Sunday morning programs. Now, last time when I ran, I was. And last time when I ran, I was given a CNN town hall. It was very deliberate strategy why they did not do that. The smears, the lies, the infiltration of my campaign, the kicking me off ballots. So absolutely, I feel that if I had been treated fairly as any American citizen qualified for the job should be, I absolutely believe I could have been a contender. Given the situation now, it would take a miracle, but at this point, I will take whatever I can get that will enable me to contribute to what is happening in this country. I believe that the issues I'm talking about are absolutely important, and as I said to you before, any vote I get increases the possibility that it will influence the platform and possibly the president's agenda or whomever is the nominee.
Do you see President Biden having to stay in power to last this election? Would you prefer having a debate with our sitting president?
I have been asking for a debate, as Dean Phillips asked for a debate. It is absurd we didn't have a debate. The DNC came up with this narrative, and it's nothing more than a PR concoction, that you don't primary an incumbent president. Now, I am old enough to remember when Lyndon Johnson was the incumbent president and Eugene McCarthy primaried him. Bobby Kennedy Sr. primaried him. Nobody thought that was weird. It was called democracy. And it was also a very important primary because it led to the end of the Vietnam War. So this idea that nobody primaries an incumbent president was absolutely undemocratic. Candidate suppression is a form of voter suppression. Absolutely. And I've been calling for the last year for the president to debate me. And if the president wouldn't even debate me, how's he going to do in a debate with Donald Trump?
What about his staying power? What about his health? What about his vice presidential, his vice president Kamala Harris? Do any of these things concern you?
Of course, they concern me. And I think more importantly, it concerns a majority of Americans. They've made that clear in poll after poll. The majority of Americans are concerned about the president's age. And apparently, the Democratic establishment elite thinks that they can just close their eyes and cross their fingers and just will their way into a victory. This is very disturbing. Americans are disturbed by this. And the vice president is not popular either. So, and also the polls showed recently the president is not doing well against Trump in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, important swing states. And the Democratic establishment is in complete denial here. And they put the Democratic electorate into a kind of trance-like state. We have to go with Joe. We have to go with Joe. No, that's not how democracy works. A lot of people should have run who felt like running. There should have been a robust debate, and that's how the candidate should have been chosen. We should not be anointing someone. That's not how democracy is supposed to work.
You know, what's fascinating is that former President Donald Trump, with all his indictments, his legal woes, his polls across the board shows him not just neck to neck with the sitting president, but that he's beating him in many of the polls. What do you attribute this to? What are the voters saying in this election?
Historians will be writing about this for decades. The psychological makeup of the American mind. I think what we have to deal with is the situation at hand. And the situation at hand is the following. People who love Donald Trump love Donald Trump. We can sit here and analyze about why they love Donald Trump, but they love Donald Trump and they have a right to love him and they have a right to vote for him. We could indict him 91 more times, they'll still vote for him. We could put him in prison, they'd still vote for him. That's not where the electoral risk lies for those of us who do not wish to see the former president return to the White House. The electoral risk for us is people staying home. And that's, again, why I'm in this race, because the agenda that is currently being submitted to the American people on behalf of the Democrats is not exciting enough. It does not meet Donald Trump at the level in which he needs to be met. There's a lot of, but the president has done so much. Well, he's done, I'm certainly willing and eager to give him credit where credit is due. But the truth of the matter is that his economic policies have not made a difference in the visceral experience of the majority of Americans. Americans are drowning in this country. We're drowning. I'm not. I'm in top on that top 20% of earners. If you're among the top 20% of earners in the United States, then you're doing well, and that's to be celebrated. But it's like you're on an island surrounded by a vast sea of economic despair. The way our capitalist system is working right now, it is predicated on a permanent underclass. And that kind of ubiquitous pain and stress and anxiety, then we call it a mental health crisis. But there's no way to overstate the role of economic inequality in creating all that mental stress.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode.